NAP, not applicable to politics. If you kill your enemies, they lose. Originally published by Evelyn Grant on the 5th of October 2021 for the Anti-Politics Substack. The non-aggression principle, or NAP, is a general notion that it is wrong to aggress or threaten aggression on a person or their property unless done so in a manner which fits into a more often than not strict and immediate sense of self-defense. As a tool for teaching children and the uninitiated how to think in an ethical sense, it is reliable and robust only when left unchallenged. Therein lies the problem. Not only does it begin to seem idealistic in the abstract where issues of who aggressed first and what constitutes aggression arise, it becomes all the more laughable when considered as a ground rule one must accept to be a libertarian, or even a politically active one, at that. Libertarianism, in the majority of its forms, stands out as an ideology which goes to great lengths to delegitimize the use of force in all aspects bar self-defense, but this makes it, in a very important sense, an incomplete ideology. It can make great theoretical refutations of state actors and their violent actions, yet offers little in the way of how to rid society of those actors, especially in a practical sense, other than telling you to wait until the first shot has whizzed past your head. It can explain the world around us, but only offers pacifism as a method of change. This may be recognizable to some as a hallmark of libertarianism's liberal roots. It speaks to an indifference that one would have to violence, that any aggression outside of the realm of direct self-defense is anti-liberal and therefore tyrannical in nature. Marxism, conservatism, neoliberalism, to name just a few, have no problem in identifying an enemy to which the use of force can be justified. They do this as they exist within an explicitly political world. Whether consciously or not, they have taken on board an important lesson that has been evident since the French Revolution, that the political unity and singularity of the state as a final decider in any and all cases was still true, but the faction that could declare itself as the supreme by whatever means was able to take the reins of the state. No longer was the state as such a neutral and faraway body. It was a means for antagonizing domestic conflict among groups, classes, races, and religions. To quote, any religious, moral, economic, ethnic, or other antagonism will turn into a political antagonism if it is strong enough to effectively group people by friend and enemy. Carl Schmitt. In short, political actors were now part of a Machiavellian operation to seek dominance for their tribe as part of the never-ending struggle of politics. This conflict, and ultimately dominance, demanded that some portion of society be segmented from the rest, a distinction that must be made as to who should rule and who should not, who should be able to subject their fellow man to ill treatment, and who should be treated with such enmity. This is why Schmitt goes on to say that the specific political distinction to which political actions and motives can be traced is the distinction between friend and enemy. Libertarianism sees itself as existing outside of this struggle. It suggests that to dominate at all is to somehow wrong, and that it is inherently illegitimate, no matter what the justification. Now, while I see the value in a system of ethics existing outside of the concept of both the state and politics, it would be insane to suggest that such a system should somehow solve the state and political conflicts, ever-intensifying conflicts at that, and doubly so when it cannot manifest a motivating friend-enemy distinction. During the Bolshevik Revolution, the intensity of the political conflict was reaching new heights. Institutions such as the Cheka were set up to act as secret police to carry out politically motivated attacks. This is known as the Red Terror, a period from late August 1918 to 1922, within which Lenin, as the de facto leader of the Bolshevik forces, declared the kulaks as their enemy and demanded they be dealt with in a way that only a true and absolute enemy deserves. Lenin had, in a sense, manipulated his faction and the Russian state into a situation whereby war was the only viable option for any of his opponents. He forced his enemies to come out of hiding as to continue politics by other means. This allowed Lenin to unleash absolute enmity as the war of absolute enmity knows no containment. This can obviously be seen in the letter circa August 1918. He not only asks for the direct use of violence against his enemies, but demands a display of it so as to ward off any would-be opponents. To quote, "Comrades, the Kulak uprising in your five districts must be crushed without pity. You must make examples of these people. 1. Hang, and I mean hang publicly so that people see it, at least 100 Kulaks, rich bastards and known bloodsuckers. 2. Publish their names. 3. Seize all their grain. 4. Single out the hostages per my instructions in yesterday's telegram. Do all this so that for miles around people see it and understand it, tremble and tell themselves that we are killing the bloodthirsty Kulaks and that we will continue to do so. Yours, Lenin. P.S. Find tougher people." End quote. The response to this was the unification of many Russian forces under the title of the White Army. So too did the leader of the White Army declare himself as the supreme leader of Russia and its armies. This was a losing battle, but it is interesting to note that the enemy faction saw its most important moves as one, unifying as an attempt to be a larger political force than Lenin's Bolsheviks, and two, declaring a member of said faction as the supreme, as the one sole figure that gets to decide who is the enemy and what should be done unto them. If only they had told Lenin that his actions were against the NAP, and that he was going to be a tyrant if he continued, I'm sure the Bolshevik forces would have downed their arms and joined their fellow countrymen in singing Kumbaya, hand in hand. In an age far past the Russian Civil War, and beyond the student activist chants of the personal is the political, politics is no less decisive or violent. Clever strategists and NGO organizations have made use of violent groups such as Black Lives Matter, Extinction Rebellion, Antifa, etc. to dissuade the construction of meaningful anti-state friend-enemy distinction. In a society where anything and everything is ever more politicized and struggled for, right-wingers are tricked into fighting made-up factions that can be replaced moment to moment and are merely the shadow puppets of those holding power. One must understand how not only through the aforementioned groups, but through publicly provided services, democracies, corporate socialism, and the welfare state, the ability of any individual or group of individuals to live ethically outside the system has become impossible. Libertarian thought cannot deal with this paradigm, not if it must abide by the NAP. The phenomenon of totalizing political mentalities has only ever become more normalized as liberal democracy enshrines itself as the status quo, an implicit assertion that by no other process could we organize society. This mindset is the reason why anyone who struggles otherwise is distinctly anti-progressive, secessionist, anti-democratic, or anti-pluralist in tone and is dealt with the utmost derision. Not only are you a racist neo-Nazi who hates the gays, you clearly also went every man, woman, and child along with you dragged back into the Dark Ages. So in turn, you are no longer granted the privilege of civility. We must heed the words of Hillary Clinton in 2018, when she quite plainly and masterfully stated on international news that the GOP, Trump supporters, and any identifiable deplorables should not be allowed to carry on with their lives in peace and that they should be publicly harassed so that others will know. Lenin would be salivating at the thought. Not only has she de facto declared herself as the leader of the anti-right faction, she is designated the enemy and what should be done unto them. Clinton even picked up on the idea that the most effective political harassment should be done for all to see, and that this order wasn't just given to troops of the specific organization, it was stated in the press for all eyes. She played an important role in helping to solidify the political antagonism amongst her in-group and its followers, not only targeting their enemies, but leaving a direct threat in the air to those who may consider stepping out of line. The basket of deplorables was seen as a political misstep within the moment, but fed into a grander narrative of Trump supporters et al. As the violent other, helping underpin the perception of the January 6th insurrection. Moments like these became bookmarks in the progressive struggle for peace across the one world they so desire. Not only are progressives conflictual, but expansionist. The implicit threats against those who have not yet stepped out of line are threats to both sides. Not only can you no longer just be with the enemy, you must be with us, and you must remain with us, or else. In doing so, progressives clear the political sphere of neutrality in an effort to unify the political structure towards greater conflicts. The only attempt I have come across which reflects a conscious understanding of how the state apparatus and its permutation into a politicized public can be dealt with is a footnote within Rothbard's Ethics of Liberty. Amongst the chapters on self-defense, Rothbard describes what he calls the maximalist view of self-defense that still fits within the NAP. He describes a situation wherein a storekeeper is dealing with an urchin who has stolen one of his products. Rothbard asked the question of whether or not, under pure libertarian law, it is acceptable to kill the urchin. As the urchin has chosen not to uphold libertarian law, the shopkeeper is well within his rights to retaliate, and in theory, yes, he can kill the urchin. At which point a footnote is mentioned. On the maximalist view, furthermore, socialists, interventionists, and utilitarians would, by virtue of their views, be liable to execution. He goes on to dissuade us of this view, as it suffers from a grotesque lack of proportion. Now, while this may be true in the case of the urchin stealing a candy bar, and that Rothbard's suggestion that in this case the urchin too has rights may be worth listening to, but the footnote is taken into account as a political statement. Rothbard's focus on equal treatment becomes his downfall. There is no long-term advantage in being the fairer side when your enemy stands against your own autonomy and dignity, as that's what enemies are for. To quote, the political enemy need not be morally evil. He need not be aesthetically ugly. He need not be an economic competitor. He is just the other, the stranger, and it is sufficient to his nature that he is existentially different and foreign in a particularly intense way, Carl Schmitt. Schmitt, without knowing it, has conversely identified the issue that Rothbard has fallen for. If you cannot mistreat anyone under the standard of proportionality, then how could you ever have an enemy? When property and libertarian law are the highest values and evidently cornerstones of civilization, are not only questioned but attacked both by individuals and the state, that makes these attackers existentially different. It could even be argued that it is directly against human nature to act in such a manner. Then why shouldn't we treat our opponents as animals? To quote, a member of the human race who is completely incapable of understanding the higher productivity of labor performed under the division of labor based on private property is not, properly speaking, a person, but falls instead into the same moral category as an animal. Hans Hermann Hoppe. The irony should not be lost on us then that leftists are generally herded like cattle from one progressive project to the next, from one battle to the other. The case of weak morals and non-existent scruples can be clearly shown through an understanding of libertarian theory. Whilst Hoppe's formulation of covenant communities, which allows for physical removal, is handy, it is still limited by its ethical considerations. If leftist actors operating at the state level or not can continue to attack property rights, they are our enemy and must be treated as such. We must separate ourselves from the shackles of pure ethics and strike back, for it is the moral thing to do. This can only be done through hijacking of local government, whilst democracy and the welfare state remain national norms. It is vital that you make life insufferable for its proponents in your local area by any means necessary. A locality, never mind the society, that still propagates these ideas can never come under the rule of libertarian law. Zero tolerance must be the way forward, and it can be done. A zealotry of the highest order justified by natural law would appeal directly to man's soul and dignity in a way that would have modernists quaking in their boots. Politics has no second prizes, no honor awards, and no rules of engagement. Our enemies are always conscious of this. The more important question is, are you? And we finish with a final quote from Carl Schmitt's Concept of the Political. Nothing can escape this consequence of the political. if the pacifist opposition to war were so strong that it could drive the pacifists to war against the non-pacifists into a war against war, this would prove that it really had political strength because it would be strong enough to group men according to friend and enemy. If the will to prevent war is so strong that it no longer shuns war itself, it has become a political motive, i.e. it affirms, if only as an extreme eventuality, war and even the reason for war. At present, it seems to be a particularly promising way of justifying wars. The war then takes place in the form of an absolute war of mankind, an absolute last war. Such wars are necessarily especially intense and inhuman wars. Going beyond the political, they must at the same time degrade the enemy in moral and other categories and make him an inhuman monster, which must not only be repelled, but definitively destroyed, i.e. he is no longer merely an enemy to be pushed back within his borders. But the possibility of such wars shows especially clearly that war still exists today as a real possibility, and it is on that alone that the friend-enemy distinction and the realization of the political depend. Thank you for listening. This, again, was one of our Substack pieces. Do click on the link. It's in the cards. It's also in the description to get to the Anti-Politics Substack, where we have a lot more writing like this. This is, as I said in the intro, one of the older pieces from October in 2021, so nearly 2 years old at this point. Please do donate if you enjoy our work, and there are lots of different ways you can support us, even if it's just leaving a comment. I know it's slightly annoying YouTube-y stuff, but it is really how the game is played. Anyway, thank you guys for listening and have yourselves a good evening.